Welcome to Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show with Maureen Howard. From making your own cleaning products to composting, recycling, keeping chooks and reducing your carbon footprint, Maureen and her guests will inspire you with practical, everyday solutions that make a difference. Eco Living in Action, proudly supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
And kia ora, welcome to Eco Living in Action on Otago Access Radio, ko Maureen Howard Ahau. This week on the show, we're going to be talking about what we can learn from Indigenous communities to help us share environmental education. Now, this show is very apt for right now. I'm writing an article on environmental education and the power of the Te Ao Māori worldview in helping children to relate to nature in a much more ecocentric way. That's an ecological way, rather than the traditional anthropocentric way that we're used to in the Western world. My guest is a very special person. Carolina Duque is originally from Colombia, and she's currently just completed some postgraduate papers in education here at the University of Otago. Now, Carolina has worked in six different countries on diverse aspects of environmental education, from process theater in Nicaragua to digital education in the Middle East to building permaculture gardens with children in Colombia. Her approach was transformed when she stayed with Indigenous communities in the Amazon rainforest. So in this show, we'll find out what she learned about the communities there and how it has committed her to a non-colonial approach to practicing environmental education. So this show was recorded on the 14th of June. So Carolina, now tell me, how did you get started in environmental education? You don't look very old to have worked in six different countries.
Yeah, it's been brief, but definitely started early on. How did I get started? That's a good question. Well, I think I approached the education path through more of a peace-building kind of social justice approach. It was when it started in neighborhoods with high violence rates back in Colombia. That's where I was born and raised. And soon enough, I discovered that environmental justice is central to peace building, and more specifically, food sovereignty, food security, and community building. And yeah, so I started exploring the paths of environmental education and just realized that it's probably the single most important thing we should be doing today.
I'd agree with that, actually. But is it mostly with children that you've been working?
Yes, it is mostly with children.
Right. So, and primary school or older, all ages? Or?
It's been very eclectic. Yeah. So, lots of ages. Right. From the youngest kid I've worked with was 2 in Nicaragua. She's just fantastic. Until 17.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And so obviously they all need very different approaches. And so you were kind of, I guess you're the kind of person who's able to adapt quite quickly.
Yeah, I would like to think so, especially working in so many different cultures and with so many different ages. I think it requires a degree of empathy and listening, and that's something I've learned with time, I guess. To me, it is very important to consider play and discovery at the center of learning. Mm. And not thinking about myself as the knowledge holder, but rather a facilitator of the discovering process.
Right. Yeah. So it's very much child or young person centered.
Yeah, student centered for sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'm really interested in this point that you had in your life, because obviously we could do several shows probably about what you've learned and what you've done, but to kind of jump forward to that point where you went to the Amazon, which particular country was it, in Brazil or Colombia?
I've actually been to the Amazon a few times,
yeah?
But the most significant time when I spent the most time there, it was in Peru, in the high Amazon. Yeah,
right.
But I visited the Colombian Amazon, the Brazilian Amazon too.
And so what kind of things were you doing there?
Well, the time when I went to Peru, I actually went with a couple of professors from the University of British Columbia. That's where I got my undergraduate degree. They are both First Nations from Turtle Island, which is Canada, known as Canada too. And we went there to learn from and with Indigenous elders. But because I've been there before and because I was raised in South America, it was very meaningful to me to go back and learn from them. It was just eye-opening and honestly life-changing.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, even, you know, were you primarily brought up in a sort of like a Western ideology, would you say?
Absolutely, yes.
Like the rest of us, yeah.
Yeah. Brought up in a city in Colombia. City in the midst of a civil war, which also adds another layer of complexity to how I made meaning of the world and what peace and justice meant to me, has really changed across the years, for sure.
Right, okay. So what did you learn from some of the things that you learned from the elders there?
Oh, wow. Big question.
I'll just put you on the spot then.
I think it has to do with a conversation that is constantly going on between the non-human and the other than human. And by that I mean plants, other animals, but also other beings that inhabit the rainforest. And that is a whole different epistemology. And by that I mean way of knowing that some communities have mastered. And it has to do with really a relationship that goes on between people and place. It is a respect between the exchange that always happens. So, for example, it's not about taking from the land, say, food or medicine, but rather a constant giving and taking. It's never really seen as giving and taking, rather the continuation of a cycle. So one of the most beautiful things that I learned there, and that I am still learning or unlearning probably, it is the notion of the self. So for some of these communities, and I must say that communities in the Amazon and indigenous communities in the world are very different between each other, so I don't want to just put them all in one single category. But what I learned from these particular communities was that their sense of self is very different from ours. It is not the idea that you are an individual and that you compete for your own well-being, but rather identity is this continuum where plants, spirits, and other people make you who you are, to the sense that their well-being is your well-being. Mm. And that is just so important.
It is so important. And it's kind of that lack of perspective that we've had, seeing ourselves as just this individual, that it means that we're not looking forward to the future and we're not seeing ourselves as part of the earth, isn't it? So it is really critical, isn't it? And so when we talk about it, we talk about the, you know, the non-colonial worldview and the colonial worldview. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the center of my understandings right now, and I know that might change in the future, but that the main difference between those two has to do with ownership, I believe, and this buzzword called resources that we hear everywhere. Every you know, from natural resources to human resources, and the idea that things are there to be owned and to be exploited. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that's at the center of the colonial epistemology, the colonial way of knowing. And likewise, the idea that knowledge is this thing to be consumed and that you possess as you become older, say, or you have more power, and then you have knowledge, and then, you know, it's this power game. But in the non-colonial way, it is this idea that knowledge can be, well, it comes from place, it comes from land. So there's amazing scholars like Leanne Simpson that writes Land as a Pedagogy, for example. The idea that if we listen carefully, we learn from the other things around us, and then we understand that they're not there for us to take them and to get instant satisfaction, but rather to nurture each other. So the non-colonial way is rather symbiotic as opposed to, you know, being a parasite.
Mm.
And there's another really important point in that distinction, which has to do with sites of learning, what I like to think about as sites of learning. And in the colonial way, we tend to put a lot of emphasis in the mind and the cognitive. So say for when you look at schools or even, you know, other learning environments, we are sitting down, we are in rows, we are silent and working with our brains. But if you go to other communities, the learning way is rather engaging the whole body, all the senses. So this notion of phenomenology or experience, what you can learn from climbing a tree, from using balance, from engaging your whole self into the environment.
Right. Yes, because by sitting still and just using our brains, we're just using that thinking part of us, and we're not connecting or feeling. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. So
yeah.
Get out of the classroom.
Absolutely.
And so you also, now you've used this word eco-literacy, and can you tell me what that means? Because I think of, you know, eco-centric or ecological, but how do you define eco-literacy?
Okay, so it's a term that I've used for a while now, and it's definitely, I've taken it through this whole process. And what it means now is very different to what it meant before. Before, I thought eco-literacy was to know about the environment. In a very colonial way, ultimately. So to understand processes and, say, the food system globally, and to know which plant does what. But now, after living with these communities, I've understood that eco-literacy has to do with meaning-making from nature, and that has to do with understanding that we are part of nature.
Mm.
So it is radically post-anthropocentric. And yeah, ecocentric.
Yeah, because there's that other aspect, you know, of in our anthropocentric, kind of we're at the center of the universe, and you see things from your own perspective, and as you say, and then it encourages you to think of other things as resources. But in the ecocentric, you're not the center. It's kind of it's a big web, isn't it?
Exactly.
And you're part of it.
It's the idea of networks as opposed to a pyramid.
Yeah. So I really feel that it's really important, and what can we do to kind of shift our perspective, and like what are some of the things that you might do with children that are brought up in a Western perspective to help them shift?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is get them out of the classroom and into the world around them, ultimately, into the natural world. And I say that with to call these things world air commas, I don't know.
Yeah, she's doing lots of air commas.
All these buzzwords that are problematic.
But,
for example, say in Nicaragua, we were living in this village on the coast of the Pacific coast, and instead of going inside a classroom and learning, say, about turtles or about permaculture and gardening, our classroom was the beach. Our classroom was the garden. And so when you get your hands in the soil, there's a learning that is happening. There's a listening. There's an observation that is happening. And I think that's the first step.
And that it just kind of comes maybe automatically once you start doing that.
Because the kids start asking questions and they become interested. Now, I believe that the curiosity and play are the best teachers, really. For example, I volunteer at Orokonui, the eco sanctuary, and sometimes we go for forest walks with the children, and we just do that silently, listening to the birds, to the tuis, the bellbirds, and at the end we come back and we sit in a circle and we share what have we learned. And the children come up with all these great ideas and all these great questions that they would have never... I don't think they would have come up with them if we had sat in a classroom and learned about the tui bird.
Yeah.
You know, with a very scientific Western lens, that learning would have not been there.
So I'm thinking, you know, like, we're very lucky here in Dunedin. You know, we can connect with nature very easily. But what about a child who's living in the middle of a huge city? What are the opportunities there for them to connect?
That is a great question that I don't have the answer to. And it's what it's really scary to think about is that more and more as cities grow, we're losing the sites of learning that are ultimately, I believe, what is going to save us from the possible societal collapse that we're going to go
because through. It's happened because of our disconnect, really. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And perhaps, you know, it's been inevitable, you know, when you were staying with in the Amazonian community all the time, like 24 hours a day, they're immersed in a natural environment. And so it's kind of inevitable that they're going to have, you know, an ecological mindset. Whereas in the cities, it's really easy to get disconnected. I do sometimes see, you know, like the little weeds poking out through the cracks.
Shout out to those.
Yeah, and I think about the resilience of nature, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I think there are places in the city, you know, where children can connect, you know, and you do hear, yeah. So, but it's harder. It is harder, yeah.
Yeah, but I think even, that's a great point. I was talking with an outdoor educator back in Vancouver, and his point was that he was saying, every city has nature. There's no way we can't live without it. So bring your kids outside, anywhere, to any patch of grass, any tree around. Even that will create a sense of wonder and learning.
Yeah.
And connection.
If you get close enough down to the grass, you can see things.
There's always things happening.
Yeah.
The little communities happening everywhere.
That's right. I used to imagine it was like a big forest, you know, in the moss, you know, like a big forest and the little creatures are going around.
Yeah.
So this is really profoundly affected you and how you're doing things. Like, where do you see you might end up, or are you still got more adventures to have?
Ooh, that's what I've been thinking about in the last few days, actually.
Yeah?
I dream about having, you know, educational settings. I don't want to call them schools because I really want to try to reimagine what a school could be and look like. But being part of projects that are creating spaces where this kind of learning could happen. And it's not only connecting with the land in a non-colonial way, but also, this is beautiful concept about an ecology of knowledges, and that the Sousa Santos, he's a scholar, he writes about, and I think it's such a beautiful thing to think about. And what he says is, it's not either or. It's not about getting rid of scientific knowledge and Western understandings, and you know, but it is finding a way to bring them together, all those different ways of knowing, in a way that they can work together. Because right now we have no time, really. And if we can bring that scientific knowledge in and bring that decolonial perspective in too, and have them work together towards weaving the future we imagine and we want, then that's ultimately what we should be aiming for. And I know that's a very philosophical conversation to have right now. I am not sure how that looks practically entirely. And I think that's the path that I'm going into right now. Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, that'll be interesting to see what you do. Because in a way, like, in part, it's the heart and the head to some extent, isn't it? The connection and disconnection. And science does have a lot to offer, huge amounts, because it's always growing and learning and changing, and it doesn't get stuck. And it is a really useful way of thinking.
Absolutely. But it is one way of thinking. And that is what we have to bear in mind. That is one tool of the many we have. We just need to act now and realize that there's so much knowledge out there that we still have to, you know, respect and honor. And and then there's a whole conversation about power dynamics when we engage with non-Western ways of knowing, because they've been so oppressed for so long. And that's also a careful walk to walk, but a necessary one, I think.
And at the beginning, when we were first talking, you mentioned, you know, your desire to, you know, your interest in social justice and things like that, and that this ecological or eco-literacy viewpoint has kind of really affected you in that domain too? In what ways has it affected you there? How has it changed you?
Well, I think it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, which had to do with the notion of the individual and the competition, and how that used to be the way I understood life for a long time. And being close to the notion of equal literacies and the notion of deep community has really, just changed the way I understand peacemaking. I don't know how to answer that question. But
Rather than looking at in winners and losers or something and the good people and the bad people,
yeah.
it's a different way of framing it there too, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. And you've been getting involved in Dunedin here, haven't you?
Yeah.
What kind of things have you got involved with?
I really love it here. Ah, fantastic community. I've got involved with Extinction Rebellion, which is a great group of activists. Oh my God, so inspiring. Wow, shout out to all of them if anyone is listening right now. And it is an environmental justice activist group that is happening all over the world, and they're doing fantastic things. One thing I really enjoy about Extinction Rebellion is that the way we operate is very non-hierarchical. So it's this notion of horizontalism, as in from the word horizontal. And the idea that there's not really a leader, but rather we're all constantly co-creating what it means to be an environmental activist. And we also work with non-violent direct action, which is very central to what we do. So direct action as in disruption, because ultimately we really have no time to just be sending petitions and just be talking to people. We've been doing that for long enough. So the disrupting part, the direct action part, is really central to what we do, but the non-violence is most important.
Yeah, because you want to bring people along with you, don't you? You know what I mean? We do have to wake up and see that, yes, they call it the long emergency or a crisis, but you know, we've got a limited amount of time to really make some big changes, and it's a challenge, but certainly I see that definitely there's a thread there for Extinction Rebellion to help people wake up and help us all wake up.
Yeah,
even when we think we're awake, we're not awake.
Yeah, it feels like we're sleepwalking into this disaster, really. Yeah,
but we do have hope, you know, and there are lots of things for hope too, isn't there? So where are you feeling hopeful for the future, like with the young people? Or
I'm feeling really hopeful for the future. I really am. I feel and I see that there's a huge movement happening everywhere, you name it, from industry to education to even art making, politics. People are talking about this, and more than just talking, they're doing. And I think that's where we all have to get our hands and our feet into. I am hopeful for the future generations. I know they're going to have a lot of work to do, but I'm also excited to see how societies and communities will transform. I really do believe in us humans to work together.
Yeah, that's great. Well, look, Carolina, thank you for coming to Dunedin, and thank you for coming on the show. It's really wonderful to have you on the show, and all the very best. I'll be interested to see what things you do in the future.
Thank you, Maureen, for having me here. It's been a really lovely conversation.
That's great.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening. This is Eco Living in Action, and I'm Maureen Howard. And my guest today was Carolina Duque from Colombia, who's staying in the University of Otago here and working at doing some papers. Well, she just finished. And we were talking about, I guess, non-colonial worldviews and eco-literacy and environmental education, and how it's a really key part for the future. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it as a podcast from the OAR website at oar.org.nz. We'll also be on air twice a week, so Thursday at 2:30 and Friday at 9:30. So hope to catch you next week as well. So thank you, and catch you next week.
Sustainable Dunedin City aims to facilitate a positive, secure and sustainable future for Dunedin. We're local people interested in issues of climate change, declining energy security and sustainability. Is there effect our city? Sustainable Dunedin City produces a regular online newsletter of sustainability related events, hosts regular green drink sessions and organises the Big Green Challenge. For more information or to join, go to sustainabledunedincity.org.nz.